Yep, the big question, is there life on other planets? We'll be back with more with our special guest tonight, Peter Ward, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Peter, how do scientists, geologists know that there was a collision 4.5 billion years ago with another object?
Well, it's kind of a process of elimination. We have this moon. How could we have gotten the moon? When I was a kid, I remember there was this idea that it's just the Pacific Ocean ripped out and up it went. When dynamicists really began looking at ways that we could have caught the moon, the capture idea that there was just another big body out there and just coming by, it somehow went into orbit, just didn't make sense. People started studying the moon and realized it used to be closer to us than it is now, much closer, and the only way that could have happened is if the moon really did come out of the Earth somehow. Once they started modeling, they came up with a very nice model that showed and predicted a pathway away from the Earth in the same pattern that the moon does show. And so you can't be certain. Proof is really tough in science, but everybody's satisfied.
Interesting. I mean, that's fascinating. I've always wondered how they figured that out.
Smart people.
Accuracy? Pretty good, I guess.
Yeah, huh? Just really smart people out there. I wish I could do math.
Well, you're about ready to listen to some. So let's go to the phones west of the Rockies. You're on the air with Peter Ward. Hi there.
Good morning, guys.
Yeah.
In Stephen Hawking's second book, I can't remember the title of it, but he said, at the end of the book, he said, everywhere I look, I see the fingerprints of God. And my own path, I used to be an agnostic, but then when I was about 25 years old, I started seeing how everything fits together, geology, astronomy, biology. And to me, it's a... The universe is programmed for life. As your guests were saying earlier, chemistry is the same throughout the universe. And so if the universe is programmed for life, to me, it raises the obvious question, who programmed it? I know it wasn't me, and I don't think it was you. So I'd like to hear if he has any thoughts along that line.
All right. And it could have been the illustrated brief history of time, the brief history of time, the universe in a nutshell. The future of space-time, the nature of space-time, on and on and on.
It was the second book after Brief History of Time.
Okay, very good. All right, Peter, what do you think?
Well, it's certainly a very cogent discussion, especially now. Sort of an offshoot of that is that there was a creator, and then we go into intelligent design, which is, as you know, I think your listener is thinking about intelligent design of the entire place, not just how evolution works.
Yes, that's right.
And I really can't answer it. I don't know enough. I've had a fairly long life, and I still don't know enough. I certainly see what you mean by it looks like the fingerprints of God everywhere. I think of the fingerprints of God as the smudges of chemistry, but maybe we're just using different names for the same thing going on.
I think Hawking was talking about the whole nine yards too.
I just sit here. I sort of admire you for having a better worldview than I do, because I'm just way more confused than you seem to be.
Well, I'm still confused.
All right. Thanks. Appreciate it. And, Peter, you're the same Peter who was on PBS, Discovery, the Learning Channel. That's you, right?
Yeah, that's me.
How do they find you for all this?
I guess it's hard to find scientists who can speak in complete sentences.
Or who want to stick their neck out.
Well, there's always that, too. And believe me, some of my colleagues don't appreciate it. You know, Carl Sagan really did die for science writers' sins, and I never believe that it's the case, but some scientists don't appreciate others for trying to reach out.
No, that's true. If you're doing something that is not for the Journal of Science, for example, or Nature magazine or something like that, they aren't too happy.
Well, it's just that they think you're not a real scientist, and so... It's just the way the world seems to work. It's unfortunate, but true. The scientists are being a little too short-sighted in this. It's all your listeners who fund science in America, and unless we scientists give back, why should they?
Good point. Wildcard Line, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Alex from New York.
Hello, Alex.
Hi. I don't know much about much, so this might be a stupid question. But I'm curious as to where, if anywhere, on the guest's classification chart of life would be things like prions or infectious proteins or these are things that don't have DNA. They're not viral. They're mm-hmm. even simpler than that. And but they spread from host to host like a virus does.
And they kill.
And so would those in any way be considered life? And would those be the things that one would look for on a moon or another planet or something?
Yeah, that's a tremendous question, and one that I wrestled with, and I actually had part of a chapter dealing with it because I had the same questions you did. Is a prion alive? I finally came down on the side of saying they're not, even though I do argue on and on that viruses are. You have to draw the line somewhere, and prions don't seem to evolve, although I'm not really overly confident that I've got this one right. I mean, I'm just uneasy enough about it, as everyone seems to be, that it's kind of like they're probably not alive. But, you know, it's a sensational question. It's not a stupid question at all. It's one of the most basic and interesting of questions because you've got something's alive and something isn't. It's not at the virus level, but it might be between viruses and prions.
Peter, why was the conference, the 2004 conference, unpublicized? Why do they kind of want to sneak that in with the 20 of you?
Well, there's still, you know, there's kind of a nasty backlash about dealing with aliens. There's just enough of a sort of anti-scientific flavor to it because there is, you know, let's face it, we all know there's an awful lot of crackpot stuff going on out there. And for serious scientists to say, oh, yeah, we're going to go to a conference about aliens, and you get, oh, yes, all right, so we're funding you to study alien life?
It's,
you know, Congress took the money, or Congress took the money away from SETI. And there's certainly...
Almost killed them.
Yep, it did. And there's certainly a sense that, you know, this is very serious science, trying to figure out the biology of life. What is more serious than that? And yet, because there is the attachment, the stigma, that perhaps there's some pseudoscience, it has been kept quiet.
Next up, east of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Howdy, this is Chris from Texas.
Chris, welcome.
Hey, I love your show.
Thank you.
I got two questions, one for you and one for Mr. Ward.
Right, let's do me first. Get me out of the way.
Is that Peter?
No, George.
Okay, well, I just wanted to maybe see if you could do a segment sometime on 10,500 B.C. Have you ever heard of this?
I sure have. Yep, we can do that.
Okay. And for Peter, I just wondered if you'd ever maybe noticed the similarities between, you were talking earlier about viruses getting here via meteors or comets or whatever. Have you ever thought of the similarity on a large scale of Earth being a cell and humans being viral?
Yeah, we seem to be, don't we? We certainly have infected this planet, and we're about to make the jump to others. I haven't made that particular analogy, but I've certainly seen it in any number of science fiction books. A lot of people have made that same conclusion. It seems to be a logical one that we humans come up with, and, you know, it's a great thought. The similarities are depressing, aren't they?
Quite.
How easy do you think it is, Peter, for life to form if all the right ingredients are there?
Well, so easy for me to sit here in my armchair, padded armchair, stuffed armchair, and say, oh, it's easy. The reality, George, is nobody really knows. I mean, that's the $64 trillion question. We don't know. We have yet to make life in a test tube. Some people say it will never happen. I personally think it will. You know, one whole area we really haven't talked about is sort of the downside of making life. And if it is easy to make, perhaps it's easy to make bad life, bioterrorism life, bioweapon life. And so that whole side of things, in some parts of me, hope it's not easy at all.
Well, and we talked about the possibility of some kind of an experiment gone awry and a problem would occur. But you're right. What happens if that experiment was done intentionally?
Yeah, there you go. And that's the whole category of this artificial life stuff that is the dark side of it. Let's not make life for life's sake. Let's make it to kill things.
First time caller line. You're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes. Hello.
Yes, sir. It's all yours.
Yes, George. How you doing? Hey, first time caller, long time listener. I'll tell you what. You have a great show. First off, I just want to thank you very much.
Thank you. So, what got you so motivated to make that call then? That first time call.
Actually, you send me home with goosebumps every once in a while. So I've been sitting here, and I need a couple open minds for this. And the last caller kind of stole my thunder a little bit. I got to thinking, I thought, you know, how can we be so arrogant to think that we might be the only life in the galaxy or in the universe and whatnot? And you got to talking about nano life and microorganisms that make up life and whatnot. Who is to say, and on that other hand, how can we be so arrogant to think that we might not, or we might be the small part of the organism, such as a molecule or something like that, in a larger picture, in a larger life, in our own little universe here? We may be something as simple as traveling through the bloodstream of a larger life. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Peter, it's your domain.
Well, actually, there's a fabulous scene in the Tommy Lee Jones Alien movie where they have that galaxy stuck in a little marble. And I think, you know, that's scaled up even larger than what you're saying. But,
yes,
you know, it's just my favorite cartoon by Gary Larson was the two paleontologists standing in this gigantic dinosaur footprint saying, well, I don't see any signs of life, do you?
Yeah, I remember
you know,
that.
It's all context. And you're totally right. It's perspective. It's just how we see and what we're doing. And George was talking about parallel universes, and I try to steer away from that
Correct.
Because, I mean, that very well Correct. Could be the footprint right there.
Correct. Well, thank you very much. You two have put on a wonderful show tonight. I want to thank you, and I will continue listening.
George is good, isn't he?
I remember, Peter, the old Twilight Zone portion where Agnes Moorehead, I believe her name, was that her name, Moorehead? Yeah. She was an old lady in a cavern-type home sweeping, and she heard some thud on her roof. Turned out to be what you would think would be aliens in a spaceship. And she was trying to get them. And eventually, I think she swatted them with her broom and got them both. But they ended up being astronauts from Earth. She was the giant from another planet.
Yeah, very good.
Classic, wasn't it?
Yep.
Wildcard line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Welcome.
Welcome. I'd like to say, first of all, I drive truck, and yous are fantastic. Yous keep me awake at night.
Well,
I really like your show.
You have to stay awake if you're going to drive, right?
Definitely. I have two real quick questions, and I'll listen on the radio.
Okay.
Out past the universes, how could I say it? Out past time, couldn't there be a little blue planet that sends rocket ships up for experiments, lands on another planet, and an asteroid hits it and picks up the microisms that go out into space millions and billions of years ago, landed on our Earth, and that's how life formed here. Now, in return, we're starting to send rockets out into space, like onto Mars or Jupiter or wherever. Couldn't an asteroid hit there and send our viruses out, and maybe a billion, million years from now, we could be planting life on other planets? And the other quick question I have, space is so vast, nobody actually can comprehend it. I would like to know the actual diameter of the sun compared to the Earth. I was told one time it's like 200 million times bigger than the Earth. And that's all I got to say. I thank you for your show, and I'll listen on the radio.
Okay. I don't think it's 200 million times bigger than the Earth. But you could put a lot of Earths in the sun.
Yeah, I think it's a couple thousand Earth diameters.
Something
boy,
like
I may
that.
Be way off on that deal.
I'll check that.
But the answer to question one is yes. We could very well be sending out rocks in space with Earth stuff that might get somewhere else sometime way off in the future and start life there.
Isn't it possible, Peter, that the panspermia, the theory of maybe life just merely originated here? I know you have the virus thoughts, but maybe life originated here and blew out all throughout the solar system, maybe even in other parts of the universe.
Well, that's a great thought. You know, the really cool thing, George, about thinking about how old the Earth is, 4.5 billion years, but the universe itself is only about 12 billion. So we're sort of like second or third star generation into it. There certainly could have been time for life to form somewhere else and really permeate through. And there are a group of people who think there is but one kind of life in the universe, and we are a recipient of some of these small life forms that really have gone out throughout the galaxies.
It looks like the sun is 100 times the size of the Earth.
100 times. I had a 2,000. Boy, flunk me. I told you.
Does that make sense?
Flunk me. That sounds good.
All right. Anybody want to refute that, send me a fast blast, but I'm going to go with 100 times the size of the Earth. East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast, you're on the air. Hi there.
My name is Bonnie.
Hello, Bonnie.
Yes, I'm a first-time caller.
Thanks. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yes. Peter, hello.
Hello.
Early in the program, you had mentioned that that those who were supporters of the intelligent design did not support the theory that there was life other than on Earth. But I am a supporter of intelligent design, but I am a firm believer that there is a life in other worlds similar to ours, maybe not. But the scriptures support it, because in Hebrews 11:3, it says that through faith we understand that the worlds, with the plural, worlds, were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of things which do appear. And over in Colossians, it talks about how our God, when he made things, he made all things in heaven and in earth, and everyone knows that the heavens consist of three, and that's even in outer space. So the scriptures do support that there is life in other worlds other than the earth.
Well, listen, Bonnie, you need to advertise that then, because one of my colleagues, a guy named Guillermo Gonzalez, who is a postdoc here, has gone on to write a book called Privileged Planet, and he's a strong supporter of intelligent design, but he is far and wide tried to advertise that the Earth is unique. I did not know this from Scripture. That's fascinating, and I think that word ought to really get out. I'm glad you brought that to my attention. Again, you ought to send that out on a blog somewhere, because that is not widely known at all.
It is. Well, the Earth is unique, but it just because it's unique, it doesn't mean that God, you know, because he is God, he can do anything he wants, and he can create life anywhere else. We just know life here like this, and it's nothing wrong with trying to explore to find out where it is, but there is life in other areas other than the Earth. I really firmly believe that, and the scriptures teach it, and it's unfortunate that that information is not out there. A lot of people don't know that. No, you're right.
Well, you ought to take it upon yourself to do that, because that's great information.
And by the way, here I'm reading something that simply says that the sun is 100 times larger than the Earth, even though it's just an average size for a star. So it's 100 times.
Okay. Well, I've learned something else here. Yeah, I should have known that.
Its mass is thousands of times
there we go.
More, but in terms of pure size.
Yep. Okay. I thought it was bigger.
That's okay, Peter. I'm here to take care of any kinds of omissions that could occur during the program.
Well, listen, George, I see this. What did they say in Casablanca?
Yeah, really. It's called Life as We Do Not Know It. I guess I could say don't know it, but that's not accurate, is it? It's simple.
I always put the don't know it, and then the book company took the contraction out.
Oh, they did?
It's a clunky title as it is, but it gets the point across.
Scallywags. We'll be back in a moment with you, Peter. We'll wrap up with final phone calls, and I'll tell you a little bit more what you can expect tomorrow night on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. We'll be right back. On our next Coast to Coast program, first hour, we've got Linda Moulton Howe on assignment in Las Vegas. Tough job, Linda, huh? Actually, she's at a UFO conference, so we'll have Richard Dolan and Jim Barrs with her as guests first hour tomorrow, and then our Friday and the Saturday morning open lines. And who knows who will call and what will happen. When you were a young lad growing up, Peter, did you ever expect that you'd be doing things like this, writing books, being on radio shows, television?
You know, I always wanted to be Roy Chapman Andrews. I grew up in Seattle, and we never had any big museums. My mom and dad were New Yorkers, and they always used to say, no culture, and Roy Chapman Andrews and his books really got me going. So, Yeah, this is what I always wanted to do. I'm one of the few people, I think, that the dream did come true.
Good for you. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Take it away.
How you doing?
Good.
This is James from Sacramento on KSTE.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering what his thoughts were on, like, forms of life that we haven't even conceived of yet, like forms of gases or nutrients or anything like that.
Yeah, great question. And I did think a lot about those. I borrowed from a few other books where other people have really tried to push the envelope, that particular envelope, even greater. And there's a couple of fabulous but wacky ideas that there may be life in the middle of stars, that there could be life sitting in solid blocks of granite, and that you've got, you really need to sort of change your definition of what life is. But, you know, with imagination, why not? I just have to be kind of the hardcore scientist, and I had to draw the line sometimes.
Great.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate you being part of the program. All I can say is maybe more and more scientists will jump on this bandwagon now, and the real push for life out there will occur. Now, what does it all mean, though, Peter? You know, what does it mean if we find life someplace else?
Boy, isn't that a great question, George? And I try to explore that. I try to think about what it would be like, let's just say, that if SETI announced that they got a signal. And I wrote a passage in the book sort of imagining that and what would happen. And in a way, everything would be changed. In a way, nothing would be changed. We would realize we're not alone. There would be a tremendous amount, I think, of metaphysical and religious sort of experience coming out of that. And yet, in our day-to-day lives, nothing would change. The economies would still be the economies. The problems would still be the problems. In an intellectual way, we would know that everything had changed, and yet in a practical way, nothing had changed. And in that sense, I fear it might almost be a disappointment because people have wanted that for so long, and then when it happened, it was always expected that maybe, you know, we really have walked through a door into some new world, and yet the world may not be so new after it happens.
Wildcard Line, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi there, George and Peter.
Yes,
how'd
sir.
You do?
Hi.
You guys were speaking of life on other planets. I've always believed that there's life in outer space, but I always thought that if it's nearby here, it would be a small organism, like you guys were talking, viruses or bacteria. But I think they're already here, and I believe they're parasites. And us humans have named them Morgellons, and they do have a symbiotic relationship with bacteria.
Hmm.
But like George was saying, everybody wants to see a creature. And I believe Peter said maybe they get together to make a bigger shape to look like a bigger creature. And that's exactly what these things are doing at my house.
And, well, it's not a bad thought. And your sense that, you know, that there's really no reason to say that there are not aliens on Earth, aliens being non-DNA life as we know it. Again, the way we check for aliens is using sort of a DNA paternity test, and there may be plenty of life that's not as we know it. We just haven't been able to find it yet.
I'll tell you what amazes me, Peter, is the apparent resiliency of this stuff, whether it's a virus or bacteria, how it can go through an atmosphere when things burn up. We saw, God forbid, what happened to the space shuttle. But these creatures seem to survive.
Boy, isn't that the truth, George? And the more we study, the more we find, the tougher life seems to be. I'm just amazed that the temperature is extremes, high and low, that life can go through. It's really amazing.
Yeah, you know, I'm looking at a picture of the Martian landscape that's illustrated in your book, captured by one of the rovers. And you know, you look at this and you say, there's got to be one little tiny organism in all that stuff.
Yep. Yeah, it's why I want to get out there and check it.
Do you believe that Mars once could have possessed the kind of intelligent life that we have here now? Something horrible happened to the planet. I want to get your take on that, too. But do you think that was possible?
You know, it's funny you say that. We always thought that one of the things you needed for life is plate tectonics. There's a long series of reasonings, but the Earth has really been good for life because it has what's called planetary thermostat, essentially. Plate tectonics has kept the temperature of the Earth stable. We always thought you needed plate tectonics for life to get to animal grades. But other people thought Mars may have had oxygen early and may have had a window 200 million years long when all the evolution that took us so long to take place could have been compressed in shorter times. I don't know if I believe that intelligence ever arose on Mars, but animal grades, the complexity of animals, certainly could have. And that's one of the reasons, one of the first people to get off the space probe that sends people to Mars ought to be a paleontologist. We really need to make robots that can not only look for life, but look for fossils.
Good point. West of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, good morning. I'm Joe calling from Albuquerque.
Hello, Joe.
Hi, I just got a question for Peter.
Yep, hi, Joe.
Yes, sir. One of my prophecy books, I read that Charles Darwin believes that we are either man-made or we came from the sun. Now, I'd like to know if you agree with that, and that's my question, and I'll hang up and listen on the radio.
Okay.
Thanks, guys.
Well, you know, all of us came from parts of the sun in one way or another, but go ahead, Peter.
And all of us are man-made. I knew my father. He had every bit to do with making me, and I certainly am in his image. In terms of the other, I don't know. Can't answer it.
So I'm looking at Europa now, pictures in your book, and they've got these cracked areas.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
What created that, though?
It's Jupiter. Jupiter must be a tough thing to orbit around. The reason that Europa isn't frozen solid is that as it orbits around Jupiter, Jupiter flexes its gravitational muscles on the interior of Europa, making it warm. I mean, there's volcanic springs at the bottom of the European Ocean caused entirely just by gravity from Jupiter smashing the rocks around. It's not radioactive heat like on Earth. It's gravitational flexing, and all that flexing cracks that ice up on top. There's enough energy from all that heat coming from the bottom to produce volcanic energy that would be a good heat source and an energy source. So we may have schools of something in Europa, and people are trying to design robot submarine probes that'll get through that ice. You got to drill a hole in the ice.
How deep is it?
It's 100 miles.
100 miles deep?
Yeah.
The ice?
No, not the ice. The ocean itself is 100 miles. The ice is variable. It might be a mile or even thinner in some places, and those cracks show how you can get right down through it. So the ice wouldn't be the big problem. It would be the pressure of the great deep depth.
Man, who knows what's down there?
Yep.
First time caller line, you're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi there. This is David, the truck driver from Fresno, California.
Hi, David. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. This kind of comes from last night's guest. If we live in an expanding universe, what is it expanding from? And I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, it's been a question we've always asked ourselves. Last night's guest, of course, Ed and Chris Sherwood. We talked about crop circles. Graham Hancock before that, but what is it expanding from?
Well,
and Seth Shostak, he's talking about too, astronomy.
I know Seth so well. We have debated over and over.
Have you really?
Oh, Seth and I are great buddies. We differ on some of our estimates of
yeah, it must have been Seth's
universe.
Comments.
He's fun to debate. He's really quick.
He is quick. He's good.
We're expanding for the Big Bang, presumably. And the whole question I have is, what was before the Big Bang? I don't find it so fascinating to think about that expansion. I just worry about what happened before.
See, I'm exactly in your camp when it comes to that. And I wish I knew.
Yeah. I mean, that's the unsettling part of that whole business.
Wild card line, your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Andrew in New York.
Andrew, thanks. Go ahead.
Well, I'm a student at Columbia University, and I've attended a few lectures by David Heflin. I don't know if you know who he is. But anyway, he mentioned the Drake equation, and I was just curious how accurate you think that is, or just your thoughts on it in general.
Drake equation, of course, being the basis of SETI and the possibilities of life out there.
Yeah, I know it well. I actually modified it. Don Brownlee and I, in our book, Rare Earth, which was really the only bestseller I ever wrote, and that was fun, took the Drake equation and then added the extra terms that we think any planet or any system has to have so that intelligent life could arise. You need a lot more stuff in it. The Drake equation is way too simplified. Although there's hope, there's optimism in finding so many systems with planets, but we're seeing more and more that just having a planet isn't enough. You know, what was it about the Earth that led us have enough time to get to intelligence? And again, just in the last conversation we had, I was talking about plate tectonics. We think you have to have that to let intelligence arise. And here's one simple reason: metal. You can't get metal on a planet without plate tectonics. There's no metal deposits. You've got to have heavy metals. You've got to have heavy metals to make the electronics necessary to hear other alien civilizations.
Isn't that something, how it just all happened here? I mean, it was just as if, I get back to intelligent design. We've got a whole show on that next week. To me, it just boggles the mind how it can't be by chance. It just can't be.
Well, I wonder, though, George, because somebody wins a lottery every single day. Sometimes people get these $50 million. And can you imagine yourself if you had that ticket? What are the odds? But in terms of planets, you know, that there's so many planets out there. One's got to win the lottery once in a while. We know people win lotteries.
Yeah, but why would it happen to be ours?
Well, why does anybody who gets it? There's no reason. It's just chance happens. That's my guess about this place. Chance happens. But then that's my worldview.
East of the Rockies, you're on with Peter Ward on Coast to Coast. Hello.
Yeah, George.
Yeah.
Hello, George. Yeah, this is Ed from Pittsburgh.
Hi, Ed.
Hey, two quick questions. First, for your guests, I wondered, you talked a lot about all the conditions being right to create life, but nobody touched on the desire. You know what I mean? When you have these chemicals and minerals and all that, to make life, where's the desire for one thing to, you understand, to sustain itself? Or
you mean the fight to stay alive?
Right, the need.
Where
would that come from?
That's a tough one.
That is a tough one. Maybe it's just part of the system of life. It strives to stay alive.
It does indeed, and you go back to chemistry. You know, some chemical reactions happen once you start the ball rolling. They can't stop. Once you light that match, that thing's going to burn for a while. You can't stop it. It's just on its way and rolling, and I suspect life is like that. Striking that match burns for a while, and the fuel is gone, it dies.
Yeah, fuel is gone, but like life as we know it, we look for other fuel. That's to sustain life.
You know, it fights to stay alive.
I don't know. I guess that's
I don't know why it does, but it does. Hey, thank you. Appreciate your call. Let's move on to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi.
Hi. My name is Susan.
Hi, Susan.
And I'm calling from New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say that actually scientists have discovered very never before life forms in the bottom of the ocean, living in like methane gas where the hot gases come up. And there's also some kind of a worm that's in like a block of ice. I don't know if it's methane ice, but, you know, I saw it on like the Discovery Channel or something.
Well, you were right on both.
So I just wanted to know what he had to say about that,
okay.
And I'm going to listen on the radio.
All right. Well,
I love your show.
Thank you so much. Peter, we talked a little bit about that last week, these new life forms that they're finding way down there below.
Yeah, you're exactly right. That is really exciting stuff. Those are species that no one has ever seen before. Totally correct. Those are types of life that have been unknown to science. But if you break them open and go into their cells, you find the same old DNA and the same old chemical configuration. So they're new in respect to their species, but they're certainly not new in respect to being a life form that has been unknown on the planet in a chemical level. They're good old DNA Earth life.
Next wild card line, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Mike from San Pedro.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, looking at viruses and microbes here on Earth and the possibility of such things on other planets, do you think that there might be some sort of group consciousness like you see with ants or bees?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of people that I've, you know, science fiction writers are always there first. It's because so many of them are really bright guys and sometimes failed scientists. And I think I've seen a couple of books where just that concept has arisen. Interestingly enough, one of the smartest guys here at the University of Washington is a man named John Barrows, who has discovered and does discover some of those odd types of life the last caller called about. He works on the deep sea vents. He's an oceanographer. He goes down in Alvin submarines. He works on the deep bacteria. And every once in a while, when he's in his cups and he drinks really good red wine, he'll start talking about the group consciousness of bacteria. And we're all saying, yeah, John, right. But, you know, sometimes I think he's serious. So it's right along those lines. It's at the edge of science, but that's where the fun stuff happens. So I can't say no.
Along the same line, when you think about the evolution of higher life, could it be that the same kind of thing happens where cells kind of come together and work together to bring themselves to a higher level of existence?
Well, yeah, it's just by bringing yourself together in a cell, you get bigger, and certainly evolution really favors bigger than smaller right off the bat. You don't get eaten as much when you're a little bit bigger. So natural selection is going to make you bigger and bigger and bigger. The bravest thing that cells ever did was to become multicellular. To do that, you had to let down your cell wall to that cell next to you and hope he didn't eat you. So that was a big jump in evolution. But once it happened, I mean, look what happened. Animals, higher plants, all the cool stuff we have.
Time for one or two more. That's it. First-time caller line. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, did you say first-time caller?
Yes, it's you.
This is Roger from Cupertino.
Hi, Roger.
I sent a fast blast in about the diameter of the sun relative to the Earth. And, you know, the sun is 870,000 miles in diameter and 100 times greater than the Earth, and a million Earths could fit inside the sun.
Inside of it, that's right.
A million of them. And the questions I have for your guests is, I have read a long time ago that clays might have formed the early templates for life molecules. And also, crystals are, it seems to me, are demonstrate reverse entropy. They're self-replicating. They're self-organizing. I was wondering what he had to say about
that. Okay, minute to go, Peter.
Yep, and that's exactly why in my book I have a whole section on the potential of crystal life. You're exactly right. A couple of people have theorized the evolution of life through clay templates, and we call it the organic takeover. You start with crystal life. It's totally crystalline, and organic molecules start merging to it. They merge together. And off you go. A guy named Karen Smith was the first to come up with this, but there have been several others. A guy named Watchmoser, I can never pronounce his name, pulled that theory even further. And one of the points I try to make is that there could still be such life forms on the planet, so simple that we discount them because they'd be microscopic and look like little clay particles, and yet they do all that stuff. That's a very prescient point of view.
Peter, we're honored. First day of your book, you're on Coast to Coast. Thank you. I appreciate you being on the show.
It was fun. It's gone already?
It's gone already. You could probably go a few more hours, couldn't you?
I've done it before, but this was fun, George. I hope we do it again.
All right. You take care.
Thank you so much.
Peter Ward. The name of the book is called Life As We Do Not Know. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.